There's only one way not to be against people, and that's to find in this life what you should be authentically for. And for and against here are not separate things anymore. When you're for real life, you are for being present to the life that is being given to you by that life in the moment. And that life, there's no secrets in it. Do you know why there's people that have secrets from you? Because you haven't told yourself everything yet. No one can keep a secret from a person who understands themselves. It's impossible. It is literally impossible. Nor can you ever be moved to act against a person who acts against you. And the meaning, by the way, if somebody steals and, you know, give them your coat and all that, the meaning of that is when people attack you and you don't attack back but rather respond to them understanding that they're in pain, you are giving them your life. Because in that moment, you are no longer defending who and what you've been that lives in the same world as the person whose pain sets you off.
Buffy St. Marie, and we're out of time, so we just have a chance to say so long as we move on to the rest of this evening's, this morning's programming. So,
well, it's been a pleasure.
Same here. Thank you, and we hope to be back next week. Perhaps not. There may be some fundraising going on next week, but we shall be somewhere in the ethers and speaking with you soon. Good night and happy Thanksgiving.
Happy Thanksgiving. Come to me.
Easy like snow falls down. Come to me. It's easy. When the mind's too quick.
Good morning. This is Hour of the Wolf, a weekly program dedicated to science fiction, fantasy, and related fields of endeavor. My name is Jim Freund. This is a rare pre-recorded program, recorded, just a few hours before you're hearing this, because the weather is lousy and it's inconvenient for our guest, not to mention me. So here it is. And the recording quality is not what it ought to be, being that it's done in an apartment rather than in a proper studio. But the noise is, relatively little, but everybody's just a wee bit off mic. At any rate, you will enjoy it. N.K. Jemisin is one of the finest writers out there today, and also one of the most important, whether you're talking about the speculative fiction community or the black writer community, or how about the literary community? We'll just throw that one in for good measure. But before we get to the interview with Nora, we will have a review, a movie review, of The King and the Mockingbird, reviewed by Dan Persons. And then a bit of music, and then straight into the program. Stay tuned.
I'm Dan Persons, movie reviewer for Hour of the Wolf. There's a story behind the story of the film I want to talk about. Back in 1948, the animator Paul Grimaud joined forces with screenwriter and poet Jacques Prévert to adapt the Hans Christian Andersen tale The Shepherdess and the Chimney Sweep to create what was supposed to be France's first feature-length animated film. The production ran into problems, by which we mean money problems, because are there any others? And the producer took the film and released it unfinished over the objections of Grimaud and Prévert. That version eventually found its way to the U.S. under a number of identities, most prominently The Curious Adventures of Mr. Wonderbird, with voices dubbed by Peter Ustinov, Claire Bloom, and Denholm Elliott. That version presently dwells in faded glory in the public domain and is easily found on YouTube. But if you watch that, keep in mind that it doesn't really do justice to Grimaud's vision. You're really going to be missing a lot. As for Grimaud's intent, he finally got back control of the footage in 1967, spent the next 10 years scaring up financing to finish the work the way he always envisioned, and in 1980 released the film as The King and the Mockingbird, with the imagery cleaned up and considerably elaborated upon, a new voice cast, and new, more contemporary music by the Polish composer Wojciech Kilar. And the watching of this version is kind of stunning. It's like having a gap in the history of animation suddenly filled in. The story's a simple one. A king lusts after a shepherdess, who in turn is in love with a lowly chimney sweep. The couple is aided in their flight from the king by a supremely confident, erudite, and very large mockingbird. Chase scenes near misses a visit to a lion pit, and a foiled wedding ensue. But that's where the Disney parallels end and where the film's anarchic spirit begins. The King's Castle is a riot of design influences, including surrealist viaducts, Bauhausian glass towers, and the canals of Venice. Cueing off of the original Hans Christian Andersen story, the two lovers are actually paintings come to life, as is the king, who early on in one of the film's more bizarre plot turns usurps the story from the actual king. No explanation is given for that. It just happens. Go with it. There are such technological marvels as a fireman's pole that fires its passengers upwards, elaborate networks of elevators and trapdoors, and a giant robot. Yes, I said giant robot, because why not? There's a blind, downtrodden organ grinder who nevertheless maintains an optimistic attitude, apparently just to remind us that Prévert also wrote Children of Paradise, and a parade of lions that a group of peasants, for want of anything better to compare to, mistake for birds. In short, while Disney was reveling in its fantasy kingdoms, The King and the Mockingbird was both paying homage to and sticking a thumb in the eye of the genre, Cinderella, as envisioned by a somewhat more refined Bob Clampett. It's opening here in New York City tomorrow, November 21st, in L.A. on December 19th, and hopefully getting around to other cities or to video after that. It's long delayed, but truly welcome now that it's here. And I also wanted to point out that the founders of the Japanese animation house Studio Ghibli, Hayao Miyazaki and Isao Takahata, the guys behind such films as Spirited Away and the recent Tale of the Princess Kaguya that I talked about a few weeks ago, cite The King and the Mockingbird as inspiration for their own work. I raise that point because next week, a new documentary on Studio Ghibli, The Kingdom of Dreams and Madness, is opening in New York. It's a good insight into Miyazaki as he produces what is possibly his final film, The Wind Rises, and contemplates his prospective retirement. And contemplative is perhaps the operating term for the film as a whole, as befits the artists involved. And by the way, the very reserved Takahata not surprisingly shows up not at all in the film, although he's talked about a lot. The tone here is more heads down and get the work done than you might expect from a glimpse inside a cartoon studio. If you're looking for John Lasseter, you're not getting him here. But if you know the work of Miyazaki, then the artist befits his art, and The Kingdom of Dreams and Madness provides some interesting insights into the man. I'm Dan Persons. Remember, you can find these reviews over at mightymoviepodcast.com. And if you love science fiction, fantasy, and horror film, please check out CineFantastique Online over at cfqonline.com.
Today is November 26th, a little before Thanksgiving. It is a lousy, lousy, lousy day outside. And we are Jim Freund and N.K. Jemison, a.k.a. Nora Jemison.
Yes, that's fine.
Who has been on Hour of the Wolf many times, but only a couple of times solo, and not in a long time.
It's been a while.
It's been at least three years.
I think it was probably 2012 was around the last time, because that was the last time I had a book out. And that's the last time I was actually actively trying to do promotional stuff.
Oh, okay.
And then I had only short stories. No, nothing in 2013. I've been working on some new stuff for the Broken Earth trilogy that's coming out soon. So I wrote a book during that time, but I wasn't actually promoting any books. Do I need to sit for?
Yeah, if you could lean in just a little more, sorry.
Okay. That's better?
Yeah, that's much better.
All right.
All righty. So we are at, we should be tonight, 12 hours from now, we should be at WBAI's studios up in Harlem. But the weather, as everybody knows who's listening to this at first broadcast, sucks in the New York area. It's awful. And so with people coming in for a holiday weekend and for driving around in treacherous weather, we thought valor was the better... no, cowardness is the better part of valor. I don't know. It was better to record. And what I didn't take into account, I record in a nice, quiet place. What I didn't take into account is the pitter-patter of rain.
Oh, yeah.
So I hope everybody is appreciating the ambiance.
It's atmospheric.
Effect. It really is, literally. So for the two people who don't know, who am you? when you were first on the show, you had published a few short stories, and that was about it.
Yeah, I am a Brooklyn-based writer who now has 5 novels out and one in the kitty and another one I'm working on. So those five novels were the three books of the Inheritance Trilogy, the 100,000 Kingdoms, the Broken Kingdoms, and the Kingdom of Gods, which is now coming out in a ginormous, potentially deadly
collectible
if you collect bricks.
I do. You haven't seen the downstairs.
Oh, wow.
Oh, yeah.
Omnibus volume. So those were my first three novels, and then first three published novels. And then the two books of the Dreamblood duology, which were The Killing Moon and The Shadowed Sun. And the book that is in the kitty is a book called The Fifth Season, which is the first of the Broken Earth trilogy that will be out next year. And I am working on the second book of that, which is as yet unnamed, unofficially unnamed.
Okay.
So, yeah.
Can you give us a précis
of each of
the trilogies?
All of them? Okay.
Yes, of all of them.
All right. Well, the Inheritance Trilogy is basically about what happens when the people of a particular secondary fantasy world capture their own gods and use them as slaves. And the history of how this came to be is a big portion of the series, and the history among the gods of how they essentially betrayed each other, and how the damage that this does over the course of to human beings and to the gods over the course of three books is the focus of the story. So the first book kind of focuses on a young woman who is a member of the ruling family that controls these gods, because naturally if you have gods in your pocket, you would use them to take over the world and establish world peace, but it would be your kind of world peace, which would not necessarily be everybody else's world peace. And so they've become a bit of a tyrannical monstrosity. So she gets summoned back to the family, and she's not really part of the family, but she is related, and they drag her into the politics, and she has to essentially figure out how to survive those politics, which include godly politics, or die. The second book moves away from the royalty and into the city underneath, and focuses on a young woman who's literally just a street artist, like the people who sell at Union Square or any of those kinds of areas, who happens to be unable to see. She's blind, but she can see magic. And this is a city for various reasons that is full of magic. Gods walk among the human beings and buy lattes and trip over the dog crap and so forth. It's just they have the ability to smite the dog that laid the crap. So it's a little awkward. But they wouldn't, because they like dogs. Some of them. Anyway, so she can see the gods, but she can't see anything else. She can see the magic, but she can't see anything else. And partly because of this, she ends up embroiled in a magical conspiracy to kill gods that she ultimately has to kind of finagle her way out of. And then the third book of the series focuses on an actual god, Xie, who is the god of childhood and mischief.
Who is almost everybody's favorite god.
Who was up until that book.
Yeah. In the first two books,
he is
everybody's favorite.
Yeah, and then as of the third book, I did try to hint in the first two books that Xie is not a nice person. Xie is Loki on sugar. He's the god of childhood and mischief, and children are cruel. And in the third book, because the third book was told from Xie's perspective, we realized just how cruel he was. And a lot of people were kind of horrified to realize that, and I got lots of angry fan mail around that time.
I saw people pouting when discussing it. They were just going, ooh.
Yeah, they were just like, I don't understand why CA is so mean. I'm like, he's a kid with the power of a god. Yeah. What do you expect? you really weren't thinking this through before you read this book, were you?
I wasn't. it caught me. It was sort of like, oh,
really?
because my heart just went out.
Okay.
My heart just went out, and I thought, oh, okay, that's cool. He's cool. He's mm-hmm. he represents this. He behaves like that. Mm-hmm. He's the a bit of an underdog.
In the first book, he is one of the vehicles through which you see how the gods suffer in their enslavement.
Yeah.
Because, you know, at one point he's tortured, terrible things have happened to him. He doesn't really talk about that. But there are hints even in the first book.
In retrospect, mm-hmm. I see that you were crafty.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But nevertheless, my mm-hmm. heart went to him. I was rooting.
And he was also on his best behavior in the first book because he was trying to make a positive impression on Yaena.
Right.
By book three, he's like, nah, I'm done with that. By book three, Xie starts off in a bad position because he begins to age and he can't control that he is beginning to age and he doesn't understand why. He's the god of childhood. If he gets older, it will kill him. All of the gods have an antithesis. The god of light doesn't do so well in the dark. The god of dark doesn't like sunlight, or certain kinds of light. And in Xie's case, growing older literally for him means eventual death.
You can keep talking. I just have to make mm-hmm. adjustments to our studio here, which means turning off the very loud steam heat.
Oh, okay.
That is about to descend on us.
Gotcha.
Yeah. Okay. When the WBAI studios move allegedly in February, it's not going to be much better than this.
Oh, no. Oh, wow.
They're putting in studios, uh-huh. but they don't have the money for soundproofing yet.
Oh, okay. Well, that's still part of the New York ambiance that you got, so.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And in this case, Brooklyn ambiance.
Yeah, like the sound of knocking steam heat is part of life in the winter in New York.
Yeah, so, it very much is.
Mm-hmm.
And now you have added to this one of those nasty little things. It's like, okay, you've got the three books.
Yeah, yeah.
And now here's the omnibus edition, mm-hmm. but that's not good enough. You have to get the omnibus edition because it's got new material.
Yes, it contains the novella, The Awakened Kingdom. Which is about 40,000 words, and
that's a good size.
Astonishingly, takes up only a small portion of this ginormous volume. It felt much bigger when I wrote it, but anyway, it's a good size, but it's not a novel size. Mm-hmm. But The Awakened Kingdom. I've actually written a number of short stories set in the Inheritance Trilogy universe, and I will figure out what to do with all of them eventually. But this one, I actually needed to write it as something of a palate cleanser after working on the fifth season.
Mm-hmm.
The fifth season, well, I didn't tell you about the Dreamblood.
Yeah, you can go to fifth season and we'll backtrack.
So the fifth season...
And I know nothing about fifth season, so I'm like, ooh.
Well, I can tell you something about it.
If I shut up, yes.
Anyway. So basically it's set in another secondary world in which... for various reasons, a seismic or volcanic winter tends to happen fairly frequently. Every few hundred years, there's essentially an apocalypse, wherein it's very seismically active. All it takes is a major eruption or a series of eruptions, very similar to what happened in our world, to trigger several extinction-level events. And then people have to live through a winter of several years' duration. Those winters are often exacerbated by ash and acid rain and terrible things. So this is a world where, people have, as per their cultures, they have adapted to, constantly having stockpiles of food and stuff ready to go just in case, one of these fifth seasons descends. Their political system is designed to instantly break apart into independent polities, independent city-states whenever necessary, and still maintain or do as much continuity care as they can. And in this world, there are people who have the ability to manipulate seismic energy, and they are called orogenes. It's magic, but I don't use the word magic. And orogenes are both incredibly valuable in that they can stop an earthquake, or they can you know, prevent if like a gas pocket is about to blow and release, you know, toxic methane or something all over a nation, they could prevent that from happening. They can redirect the energy of that elsewhere, and a number of things like that. The catch is that they don't get this energy just from like nowhere or wishes. They have to take it from somewhere else. If there is an active seismic event going on, they can suck energy from the seismic energy, the movement and the heat and all that. But they can actually start things out of the blue by sucking the movement and the heat from everything in, say, like a 5-block radius, including the people and living things and so forth. So the result is that they can start an earthquake by basically killing every living thing in a 5-block radius. So people value them, but only when they're very carefully leashed and so on. And so the story follows a woman who, at the start of one of these horrible fifth seasons, she's been living in this small town. She seems like an ordinary school teacher, but she is actually an orogene in hiding. And her two children have inherited the ability from her, and she's been helping them hide, too, because people are just this horrified by the idea of orogenes in their presence that they would hunt them down and kill them. So she comes home one day from school, from teaching, and discovers her 2-year-old child dead. Apparently at the hands of their father, the kid's father. Her 8-year-old daughter has been taken by the father. So this formerly meek, 40-something school teacher going a little bit to seed, suddenly realizes that she's got to hunt down her husband and get her daughter back amid the end of the world. And that's basically the first 3 pages.
Whoa.
So, yeah. So it's a book that starts with death and horror and the apocalypse and then gets tough.
Spirals from there. Yes.
Yeah, and so by the end of that book, I was like, you know, I need something lighthearted and a bit silly.
Yeah. So that was...
That was the Awakened Kingdom.
Yeah.
And I had actually...
A bit of sorbet for your writing.
Yeah. I'd actually had an idea in mind for writing about sort of further down the line after the Inheritance Trilogy, when the gods finally do start making children again, the three.
Mm-hmm.
Because they haven't done it for quite some time, largely because a lot of the events that had happened in the Inheritance Trilogy were, let's just say, domestic disturbance. And so they have not had a good relationship for a while. And so the story focuses on Shil, who is the firstborn new godling in thousands and thousands of years. And she's a little bit spoiled, and she's a little bit silly, and she's very much... very much in a number of different ways, representing a fresh start for a lot of things. There are some allusions to things that happen in the Inheritance Trilogy. You will see Nahadoth and Etempus and Yaena again, briefly, but it's really all about Shil kind of getting her debut. So.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And Killing Moon. What's the name of that series?
The Dreamblood.
Okay, the Dreamblood.
Yeah. Now, that is a duology, and both of those are set in yet another secondary world. I like my secondary world.
Yeah.
Yet another secondary world called Gujada, which is essentially a thinly veiled pastiche of ancient Egypt in which magic actually works, and their magic is based on Freudian dream theory because reasons. Because I felt like it. Why not? And a little bit of Jungian. I am not a psychoanalyst. I am a counseling psychologist by training. I am not a Freudian, but I play one on TV. No. I am not a Freudian, but I have...
But this radio show was created by the descendant of Adler. So.
Okay, so there you go. But I have a lot of fascination with psychodynamic theory and with Jung's essentially his efforts to sort of create a mythology via the Red Book and things like that. So, mm-hmm. I do a lot of similar things in not nearly so mystical a way, but I mean, my fascination with world building and with religion building, I guess, is similar in some ways. But anyway, so in the Dreamblood, this story is set in a society that worships the goddess of dreams. And the goddess of dreams has bestowed upon her priests the ability to use dream magic. And dream magic is essentially the placebo effect amped up by 8 billion. So a person who goes into your dreams and harvests the four humors of your dreams could use a dream bile to stop a cancer's growth or to excise something that has gone wrong inside you that should not be. They could use dream seed, which is dream bile comes from nightmares. Dream seed comes from wet dreams. But they could use dream seed to regrow something that should be there. Like they could use it to regrow you an arm if your arm had been cut off. Mm. The placebo effect does not do that, by the way. But anyway, this is magic. It is still fantasy. And the most precious humor is something called dream blood. Dream blood comes from the last dream before death. And there are special priests who go into, sneak into the houses of people who are dying or ill and, essentially mercy kill them, and take that energy from them at that point.
They're almost the opposite of a sin eater. Or variant.
Sin, yeah, sin has really nothing. They don't.
Well, that's why I'm saying it's the opposite. It's but they are taking something out of a dying person.
I suppose. That's a way of.
And then what they do with it in some stories, they take the sin upon themselves, or they
not so
channel
much.
It elsewhere.
Yeah, it's more. It's much more. They believe in this society that if you die in a state of pain and fear, their afterlife is rooted in dreams. If you die in a state of pain and fear, then you go into nightmares forever.
Ooh.
Yeah, so you dream nothing but pain and fear for the rest of your eternity.
Yeah.
So their job is to...
I had a problem because I actually... And this is bad for a radio person to say.
Uh-huh.
I did not... I started reading...
Uh-huh.
Killing Moon, but I continued with the audiobook.
Oh, whoops.
And I must say that the retention is not as good.
Mm.
And as a person who's working on audiobooks, I often say this, but I think audiobooks can be great companions.
Mm. I liked the audiobooks for The Killing Moon and The Shadowed Sun.
They were well done.
Yeah, they were well done. I don't know that the voice, the woman that they chose to do the reading of it, her voice was very light. I don't know how to describe that. Sort of delicate.
Yeah.
And she's reading a lot of characters who are, you know, deep-voiced men, and in my head, anyway. So there was a certain incongruity there. But I'm the writer. I'm always going to feel that instant, it's not the voice that's in my head. So I'm never going to be a good person to judge how well my audiobooks work.
It's something I have been encountering with a lot of my friends who, since I'm doing editing and hosting for Lightspeed, I'll say, oh, gee, what? Yeah, Sam Miller, we just did... You know, 57 Reasons for the Slate Quarry Suicides. I remembered it for the first time. Long title.
Wow.
And how did you like it? And he said, I'm told it was great. I cannot hear it. These voices live in my head. Uh-huh. And that wasn't it.
I always listen to my audio productions a little later. By the time a book comes out, it's been enough time that the voice in my head has quieted down.
Yeah.
Whereas
Matt Kressel he just had a Clark's World, but we did one of his some time ago, and he said, that's the voice in my head.
Oh.
So
sometimes
different people.
Yeah, it depends on the production. Like, I do a lot of, all of my short stories I eventually put out through, not all of them, but most of them I try and get out in audio as well, because I believe in, you know, multimedia, multiple forms of accessibility, that kind of thing. And so I will often sell my stuff to Podcastle or Escape Pod and venues like that.
And you have a story coming up in Lightspeed this very month.
Oh, you're right. I forgot. I totally forgot. This is what my life is like.
It's on my schedule.
This is what my life is like. I'm like, do I have something coming out?
Unfortunately, they're not doing a pod of it, but they are.
Yeah.
But it is being published in, 2 weeks.
Yes, yes.
So people can go to lightspeedmagazine.com.
I'm trying to remember which story it is. This is horrible.
I'd have to go over to my computer. Oh, actually.
What story did I sell them? I can't believe it.
I'll tell you in a minute.
Oh, wow. So, yeah, this is my life, is I constantly have
hey, it's good.
So many irons in the fire that I can't remember which ones are burning.
Yeah, and also there's always the lead time factor.
Yeah.
Is you wrote the story how long ago, and then you sold it.
Yeah.
How long ago?
Yeah, and that one's a reprint, if I remember correctly.
Is it? Okay.
I think so. What the heck story was that? Oh, where is it? It's not Valedictorian. Is it? Oh my god, that's horrible.
Let's see. Well.
In the meantime, I will continue to battle.
In the dream time.
But yeah, I like listening to the audio versions of my stuff. I just can't listen to it immediately after I've written it. But generally there's enough of a lag that it's cooled down by that point, and I don't have a problem. Oh, you found it?
No, I found the spreadsheet.
Oh. So, with respect, though, back to the Killing Moon and the Shadowed Sun. So there are special priests whose job it is to go and get the dream blood. And they will climb into your house through a window in the dead of the night while you're sleeping and kill you in your sleep. And so Gujarin society is cool with this because they all believe in this afterlife. They all believe this is much better than dying, you know, like what if you wake up in the dead of the night and you can't breathe and you're having a heart attack, you panic, and then you get basically sent to hell for eternity because you died in pain and fear. As far as they are concerned, it is infinitely better to die at peace than it is to die in some terrible state of mind. The catch is that these priests also believe that living in pain and fear is a bad idea too. So if you do things that are disruptive to societal peace, if you are violent, if you are abusive, if you get too angry, they will also come and either calm you down or kill you, because their belief is, you know, that you are living in a state of suffering, and if our society has made you this angry, then we change the society, but if the problem is you, then we fix you. So that's the catch, is that Gujara is as wealthy and powerful as ancient Egypt is, but it also has this terrifying religion that everybody in the region around them is sort of like, you know, they're the sleeping giant. We don't want Gujara to ever stop believing in peace, because should they ever decide to come conquer the rest of the world, we will all have creepy people coming into our houses in the dead of the night killing us.
Yeah.
And that is one of the fears of their neighbors. Which is why by the, something of a spoiler, by the end of the first book, one of the neighboring kingdoms has conquered Gujara, because Gujara got a little big for its britches and tried to conquer them first. It's a long story, but there's essentially a conspiracy which one of these priests, the gatherers, the one who creep into your houses, discovers and then has to kind of sift his way through. And then the second book follows a young woman who becomes the first sharer or healer, the one who uses the other humors to grow back limbs or cut out cancers. She is the first female sharer, the first woman accepted into this priesthood. And she deals with a lot of the things that have to do with that. But she's also trying to contend with a dream plague that is afflicting Gujarat at that time. People are dying en masse in their sleep, and falling into slumber that they cannot escape from, and then their souls are being devoured within that slumber. So they're not going on to a good place. They're not going anywhere. They're just being obliterated in their sleep. So she has to figure out a way to help her nation deal with this horrible plague.
Yeah. So we've really gotten into a really good sense of your fantasy epics. You also write a lot of short stories.
Yeah, and those aren't always fantasy.
No, some of them are science fiction.
Some are science fiction, some are horror, some are interstitial, for lack of a better description. Short stories are kind of where I play around with concepts. Some of those eventually grow into novels. Most of them stay short. But I will also use short stories as like proof of concepts for a novel that I later want to work on. Mm-hmm. Like a short story that came out in Clark's World earlier this year was called Stone Hunger.
Yes.
Excuse me, I'm a little stuffed up. Stone Hunger was the proof of concept story for the Broken Earth trilogy. I was using it to test out the world building. The characters have nothing to do with the novel that is now written. And the story is really just a microcosm of the kinds of things that happen in this world. But it was one of the ways for me to try out the idea of, you know, societies that are so self-contained that they literally barricade themselves against the encroachment of the apocalypse, and just in order to survive, and orogenes who have the ability to start earthquakes and that kind of thing. So, yeah.
So, and I know I've done this one to you before in a previous show, and mm-hmm. It's the most famous bad question okay. that one can ever ask a writer of
where do you get your ideas?
Yes.
Really?
Yeah. That's the question, but let me put it the way that I would put it.
Okay.
Who are the antecedents of your imagination, of your writing? Where, what kind of stimuli have occurred in your life to bring forth these rich, very non-derivative of other people's work. It's original fantasy. You call them secondary worlds. Another person who does it so well is Karen Lord, whose writing I love. And she's another Black writer. And because she's lived in every part of the world, this woman. And people therefore make assumptions of, oh, you got this from this mythology and that mythology. And it's like, first of all, no, it's not from the islands. It's this idea is African. Secondly, no, that part is actually Asian. It's
right.
a completely original blend of fantasy and thought. And it comes from this very rich place and doesn't necessarily have a single antecedent. So that's my way of asking, where do you sci-fi writers get these crazy ideas from? I think I said it better. But
yeah,
it
is did.
But it is the same question.
It is the same question, but I mean, the reason that question frustrates the hell out of me is because where does anybody get any ideas from? These are all human beings.
Well, the answer for so many writers is frequently other writers. It's like, oh, I read this one before.
Oh, I see.
But your stuff is amazingly original. And it's
I don't think of it as such.
I mean, you're born in the Midwest. You come to New York.
Well, I lived in the Midwest for like a year. I was one. Okay. that doesn't really scan.
There are people. Yeah, but
yeah.
Okay, but you
I was born in Iowa.
You're born in Iowa.
I lived in New York until I was like from like the age of 2 to 5. So, but then when my parents divorced, I kept coming to New York every summer. The rest of the year I spent in Mobile, Alabama, but then every summer was my escape from Dullsville. Mobile's wonderful in a lot of ways. It just was not a good mesh for my personality. New York was a better mesh, even though it was kind of, I can't use certain words on the radio. Yes, okay. Not a great place back in the 80s. And we lived in Williamsburg, which was so not the hipster enclave that it is now. But, you know, it was one of the most rich and fascinating environments. And that dichotomy is probably one of the things that did feed my creativity back then. The suburban, small town, southern life juxtaposed against urban, crusty Brooklyn life. And that was my back and forth every year and learning, you know, just kind of seeing different classes, you know, my own family, shunting back and forth between it. You know, at one point we were staying with relatives and we were staying in the projects in, where was that? I don't remember. I want to say Canarsie. But, you know, I'd never lived in the projects before, and I lived there briefly for like a summer. I learned how to double Dutch there. I'm terrible at it. You know, I mean, and I learned how to run through fire hoses that somebody had popped for cooling off in the summertime. And New York was my adventure, and it was endlessly epic for me. Dad would do things like give me a subway map and some tokens and some quarters so I could call back home. And he would randomly pick a corner of the New York City map and be like, okay, this area, this is the Bronx. He would explain a couple of things that I would want to try and check out. You know, I was a teenager.
Yeah.
I was not a child. But, you know, nowadays people wouldn't even let teenagers do stuff like this. But Dad would pick a spot, give me some tokens, and be like, go there and be back by sunset. And
wow.
I'd be like, okay.
Adventures.
Yeah. So
that's
I would go
great,
forth. I would
actually
figure out how to get there. He would tell me a few tips. I would figure out how to get there. I would go see the Bronx Zoo and come back. We're not talking, you know, anything really stunning here, but things like City Island.
Actually, no, I see that as stunning because I ended up doing a lot of that on my own. I would be at one place and I would be at another place.
Mm-hmm.
And I only learned years later that these places were, in fact, only 10 blocks from each other. And so the geography never quite worked for me. And the different parts of New York were not cohesive
never gelled.
For me.
Yeah,
they never gelled.
They still haven't gelled for me.
So I think that's great.
They still haven't gelled for me. Each part of New York is its own kingdom. And they're all sort of fascinating. But, you know, it's all I needed was enough of a trigger just to kind of set my imagination going, and it just happened on its own.
What
I can
were you
remember,
reading and watching and doing?
I was reading fantasy novels and science fiction for the most part. Dad and I would stay up every night on weeknights and watch The Twilight Zone and original Star Trek on WPIX 11 at 1 and 2 in the morning. And then Dad would talk to me about it later. And, you know, Dad is as big a geek as I am. And we would do things like we would walk across the Williamsburg Bridge. And in the 80s, the Williamsburg Bridge was like most other New York infrastructure, falling apart, kind of crap. Holes. I remember seeing giant holes.
I'm not sure it's that much better today.
Yeah, well, it's better now.
Oh, okay.
Yeah,
I'll
lots
take
of hipsters. Yeah, some trust fund kid would fall through and sue it, and that would be the end of that. So it's much better now. But there were holes through the walk path where you could see the cars and so forth passing on below.
Yeah.
And I should have been terrified to walk through that, but I was just sort of like, there's trolls. Those are the trolls under the bridge.
Yeah.
You know, and that was how my head worked. And
what fantasy were you reading? You said you're reading.
Oh, I read a lot of the sort of classics of the genre. I read Tolkien, I read Eddings, I read a certain amount of that, but I was already getting impatient with that even as like a child and a teenager, I think, because so much of it just felt formulaic and not my kind of thing. I mean, obviously Tolkien was the formula setter in a lot of ways for a lot of modern epic fantasy, but
and even then he's drawing from old sources.
He was trying to create his own mythos, at least in that sense. There was a lot of originality in that sense. Other people riffed on him though, and they lost that originality in the process.
Yes.
And so I was already getting impatient with that, and I'd started ranging further afield into science fiction. But, I mean, for me, I get as much from anime, from, you know, I was watching all kinds of anime back then, and I still continue to watch it now, though not as much as I should, wish I could, and video games, and I wasn't reading a lot of epic fantasy because I didn't like it. I still, to this day, do not like epic fantasy, which is kind of painful because I'm an epic fantasy writer. So, I mean, I think maybe if you are seeing anything unusual in my fiction...
But I think that says something more about the publishing of the fantasy sometimes than the writing of it. It's the epic fantasy that you get to see, but there are other people who are not necessarily coming to print as a result. So people say, oh,
entirely possible.
Wheel of Time is selling great, then Robert Jordan dies, we have to keep the wheel spinning. And so this person takes it over, and that person takes it over. Yeah. The market is... These terms are marketing terms. They're not just literary terms.
They are marketing terms, but they're also what has thrived. You know, Tanith Lee is one of my favorite writers. I was a huge fan, still am a huge fan of her Night's Master, Death's Master. What are they called? What is the name of that series? I'm drawing a total blank.
As familiar with her as I should be. I know some of her recent short stories.
Well, her stuff seemed to draw upon an older, you know, the tradition of actual epics. I mean, that was the thing that I wasn't seeing enough of. And that's the thing that I started doing myself, is I started reading mythology as a source for the epic fantasy that I wanted to write. You know, I was enjoying the Epic of Gilgamesh more than I was enjoying the latest. I tried the Wheel of Time. It did not go well. I will try again at some point. I should read the classics or the givens of my genre. I just... Well, anyway.
Well, those, you see, they're with all due respect, I would call those the financially successful ones more than...
But it's important for me as someone who wants to eventually be able to,
earn a living at this.
Yeah, I still have a day job. I would like to... I like my day job, but, you know, at some point I might want to not have a day job. And if that's the case, I need to learn how to be commercially successful.
Yeah.
Now, there's only so far with that I'm willing to go because, you know, a lot of being commercially successful is selling a lot of stuff that fits certain comfort food for certain kinds of readers. Mm-hmm. And I'm not really that interested in comfort food. Rather, I have different comfort food.
The different comfort food that you are creating as different from so much other stuff that is being published and written and all that, you are not unsuccessful. To begin with, you're, at the very least, you are a critical success.
I would agree with that. And frankly, you know, I could live on my writing if I didn't live in New York City. Let's be, you know, really honest here. A large part of that is trying to pay Brooklyn rent. But if I were willing to live in, you know, outer Skoondakia somewhere, I would probably be able to survive on my writing, my earnings as a writer. But, you know, I actually would like to own some property and have decent health insurance.
And you have been shortlisted for God knows how many awards at this point.
I have not yet gotten a Hugo or a Nebula, but...
I was with you at your first Nebula nomination, right. You may recall.
I remember.
It was a sad but sweet night, but... a bunch of people huddled around at the Soho Gallery watching a webcast of the interminably long Nebula banquet.
I'm still grateful to this day that people were willing to sit around with me for that long.
Yeah. I mean, you know, it started with maybe 100 people there, and at the end, and of course they had to do, they had to finally get to the awards so late.
It was 4 hours.
When they got to yours, it was 4 hours.
Yeah.
And
it was like an endurance contest.
And everything was torture. The guy opening the envelope couldn't get the envelope open. It was... But that was a start, and there will be many of my favorite writers, many of my favorite writers don't even get the nominations. Some do. Rick Bowes is an often nominated writer. He's gotten the Lambda Award, and I think he's gotten a World Fantasy Award.
I thought he'd gotten a Nebula, too.
I know he's been nominated. Has he?
Yeah, I know he's been nominated lots of times, but I thought he got a Nebula. I could be wrong.
Yeah, I'm not positive. Ask him. But I know this. Mm-hmm. He says, whenever he's on the show, which I try to make quite frequent, that he has never won an award when he's been present.
He told me that.
And it's
he
like, so why that. Are you going to World Fantasy this year? You
know? I know, right? He told me that, and I'm not yet ready to stop doing that. But I don't know. I mean, I've done enough conventions now and enough promotional stuff for my books that I've reached the point of just sort of general exhaustion with conventions.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't go unless I absolutely, like, have a really good reason to. Like, this year I went only to WISCON. And that's it. Well, that was because I was guest of honor.
You didn't have a choice.
Yes, but I could have chosen to not accept the nomination, and I appreciated that they asked me to be guest of honor. But that was the only con I did this year. And Clarion, but that's not a convention. I taught a week of Clarion, which was wonderful, life-changing in some ways. But that said, I don't have a book out this year, so I don't have to be in promotion mode. Ergo, I don't have to go to any cons.
Yeah.
And I didn't.
Yeah,
I enjoy WISCON, but, you know. Yeah.
I go to about three a year, I dare say, and I don't necessarily go to World Fantasy or WorldCon. I go to ReaderCon. Because ReaderCon is just so much fun.
Yeah.
And we go to CapClave, because CapClave is like ReaderCon further south in Washington, D.C.
Oh, I didn't know that. Okay.
And there is no Lunacon this year.
I did not know that.
Yes, it has been suspended. They have no money.
Oh, okay.
So there will be no Lunacon this year. There will be one next year. And when I say next year, I mean 2016. Yeah. There will be none this coming March in 2015.
Running a con is hard work. I've done
some of that.
Too, yeah, I started up a little anime convention back when I was more involved in anime fandom. I started and ran ShoujoCon for 2-3 years, something like that.
Uh-huh.
And then we started a nonprofit foundation to keep running it. We passed it off to some other people with plenty of funding and good, competent people in place who should have kept it running, and then stuff blew up.
Yeah.
So, but that's what happens. I totally understand just how much hard work it is for people to put on conventions, and I have nothing but respect for them for that. But conventions are physically and emotionally draining for me, and then on top of that, they're not the safest places to be anymore. Not that they ever really kind of were.
I was going to say, I don't think that
they never really were.
I don't think that they've gotten any worse. I think that awareness has gotten greater.
Yeah, some are getting better.
Because of that awareness.
Yeah, yeah.
Because consciousness raising, as we used to say in the 60s, is the first step to being able to bring about change.
Yeah. Yeah,
and sometimes can swing too far in one direction, but better that, you know, so that finally, maybe, possibly, equilibrium can be found. I know that ReaderCon has done a very good job at creating awareness.
Yeah, they're definitely doing a great job of improving. I was, I've talked before about online about how I've been. I was on the ReaderCon ConCom at one point and left kind of in a huff because I was suggesting things to increase access, having a children's book track.
Let me guess, this was more than 4 years ago.
Oh, heck yeah. Oh, yeah.
Okay.
You understand exactly why I left. Because not only were things that I was suggesting falling on deaf ears, they were being laughed at. And now they're implementing these things, which I really appreciate.
It happens to me all the time.
Yeah,
and
but
maybe
it required
we should have just a conversation off mic about Lunacon 2016, because it's going to have to be rebuilt from the bottom up.
Really? Oh,
yes.
That's an interesting conversation to have at some point.
Yeah, it is.
I've only been to Lunacon like once or twice. I don't know it very well. So.
Yeah, well, I was a Lunarian going way back to my youth. Mm-hmm. And the Lunarians are more dysfunctional than WBAI. And that is, good stuff. WBAI does good stuff.
Yeah.
But when you get together and try to speak about what's to be done, emotions run high, and Lunarians, that's not what killed it. It's limping. It's limping. But that's true of a lot of conventions as well, PhilCon and all this and all that.
Yeah.
But it's time, I think, to reinvent the con everywhere because they are not always the same places. And there's a lot that can be done, and because media are changing.
Mm-hmm.
One of the things that I like about ReaderCon is that it's not a media convention.
Mm-hmm.
LunaCon had a limited amount of media, but there was a time at LunaCon where I ran the radio room.
Mm-hmm.
And now the idea of even having a radio room, people just laugh at.
Yeah.
And I'm saying, but wait, what if during the convention we had a constant MP3 stream going of just the
podcasts, just
by the people who are attending the con?
It might go over better now because there's this huge, there's been this resurgence in audio fiction because of the various podcasts that are out there and so forth. So.
Yeah.
I think people love listening.
And I've also spent, 40 plus years recording writers.
Ah, nice.
And that is a big difference between the podcast and all that.
Right.
Is that I tend to use, not with Lightspeed, but I don't run that. I'm a worker.
Right.
I'm a worker bee.
Right.
But the things that I produce are the author's voice. So. So 1 year when I told ReaderCon I wanted to do the media programming, and this was like anathema. That ReaderCon is not about media, and I said, "Oh, but what if I told you the media that I am going to present is not only going to be verbatim the author's word, but it's the author."
Mm-hmm.
And then you say, "What do you have in mind?" I said, "Who's your guest of honor?"
Mm-hmm.
And they said, "Samuel R. Delaney."
Mm-hmm.
I said, "I've got 15 hours of Chip Delaney reading. What would you like?"
Nice.
And so
were
that
they
was
amenable
the,
to that?
Yeah, that was the only year ReaderCon had a media room. It was all audio, and Chip was in there talking about the work, and and was wonderful.
Well, I mean, and ReaderCon is an excellent example of a convention that is reforming in the ways necessary to survive into the future.
Unfortunately, it had to stub its toe for that to happen.
I wouldn't call it a toe stubbing. I would call it more like a leg breaking. But
I was
yeah. So after it had its legs broken and has healed from that, ReaderCon is starting to fix itself. But it shouldn't take that kind of crisis to cause conventions to reform and refresh and renew. If they want to keep growing, if they want to remain alive, period, that's just logic.
Yeah.
But it's hard to tell people that. I understand.
It's not only hard to tell people that, but it's, something always has to happen. Mm-hmm. Now, let us hope that it is something good. And this is not just with cons. Mm-hmm. This is with society.
Yeah.
This is, let's look to the far side.
Yeah.
It's a horrible thing to even think or say now that maybe some good will come out of Ferguson. Right? I'm talking 10 years from now.
Yeah, it's too soon to even have
it's too soon to think of that because the wound is bleeding, at this moment.
New wounds are being inflicted as we speak. So.
Yeah, very much so, very much so. But sometimes they're positive things like Rosa Parks. Sometimes they're positive things like certain anthologies that make breakthroughs, like Pamela Sargent's Women of Wonder or Cherie Renee Thomas's Dark Matter, which is just coming out in ebook format for the first time ever. And these are positive consciousness raising things. And sometimes it takes somebody having had their legs broken or breaking their own legs, which is what I think happened in the case that we're discussing here, because they have nobody to blame but themselves, in my humble opinion. And but from pain often comes growth.
When the healing is done, yes. It's too soon to have conversations about certain conventions because the legs are still being broken, or certain situations in our society because the legs are still being broken. This is one of the things that I was kind of referring to in my WisCon speech this year. I put my hand in front of my mouth. The previous year when I was at Continuum in Australia.
Uh-huh. I was going to think of bringing that up, but
Well, I gave a speech at that point about because I had been sort of I brought a completely different speech to the convention, and when I was in. While I was in Australia, I got there a week ahead of time to try and adjust to the jet lag and also just to see Australia, to see Melbourne, the city I was in. And so I went around to a bunch of museums and I just kind of, I deliberately got lost on their subway, which is actually really hard to get lost on because it's all sensible and neat and works. I'm not used to that. So I went to a lot of museums, including the Melbourne City Museum, and I was amazed at how a national museum admitted fault and horror, admitted the colonialist things that had been done to the indigenous population, and acknowledged that these things were horrible and that we've got to come to terms with this and then try and find a way to repair some of the damage that we've done. And they called this process a reconciliation. Mm-hmm. And in fact, at a lot of public meetings and official meetings in Australia begin with an acknowledgement of country, where they acknowledge that the land they're standing on was stolen from people and you know, that it is the ancestral land of this particular group that used to live here, or that still lives here, and, you know, we offer respect to their elders and that kind of thing. I was fascinated by this because I realized this could never happen in the United States.
Right.
We are culturally obsessed with denying what has happened and not coming to terms with it because we're still too busy plugging our ears and going, la, 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 it didn't happen, it didn't happen. And so...
Frank Zappa's great song, It Can't Happen Here, is what comes to mind.
Even as it happens right under your nose.
Yeah. And that's from the 60s, mm-hmm. and it can be played today along with his song Trouble Every Day, More Trouble Every Day, and these songs are horrifyingly, 50 years later, still true.
Extremely relevant,
Yeah.
Well, I mean, so in that speech I said, you know, we need to find a way to reconcile what has happened within science fiction and fantasy. The fact that a lot of the mythical basis of fantasy is drawing from cultures that we don't acknowledge that we're drawing from. You know, a lot of the things that we've thought of as fairy tales, we've talked about fairy tales as if Disney, it sprang fully formed from Walt Disney's head. Cinderella, I mean, for example, where
Ashpuddle from my parents.
Really?
Yeah, I think that would be early. I think that predates the Grimms. My parents are German, of course, German Jews.
Uh-huh.
And
I had heard the Chinese version is as close as we can find to the original.
Yeah, because the Ashpuddle legend. Well, I thought Red Riding Hood was actually the one that went back to China.
I could be wrong, but I thought it was Cinderella.
But it could be both.
It is entirely possible.
It's quite possible. The point is, these are ancient legends, and then they are reworked, and they get boglerized. They get Grimm versions, which have their own. Axe to grind, as it were, and then Disney takes them and some of the things, each of them, even Disney, sometimes bring good things to them.
True.
Frozen, which is not one of my favorite movies, has done a lot for a lot of young girls who are perhaps perhaps they will come to better things, the Snow Queen, and then earlier stories as a result, maybe, I hope.
But that's an example of what I'm talking about. I have not seen
Frozen. But it is further denial, you're right.
Well, specifically, Frozen is based on a Sami legend. Sami are the indigenous people of, I want to say Finland, I don't know. I haven't seen Frozen. But
I thought it was Russian.
I don't know. What I understand is that it was originally a Sami legend, and the Sami are, like I said, the indigenous people.
How do you spell Sami?
S-A-M-I, I believe.
Okay.
Now, this is stuff I've heard. I don't know. I haven't seen the movie. I am not an expert on it. But that's an example of, you know, there have been a lot of complaints among Frozen fans about how there's not a single person of color in the movie, when this is a film that essentially came from, or an idea or legend that may have come from a group of people of color. And that's an example of exactly what I was talking about.
Everything in Frozen is different from even the more modern versions.
Yeah, it's Disney. Everything is syncretic. Everything has been added to, built upon, changed by the people that listen to it. And there are perfectly good reasons to say that, you know, the Scandinavian people are the ones who should be depicted in a lot of the roles of that film, but not all of them.
Yeah.
They should not be the only people there.
And the interpretations are always different. One of my favorite animated films of legend, Kirikou and the Sorcerer. This is a movie, you would be fascinated, might even enjoy seeing this movie. I'll see if I can arrange such a thing. Uh-huh. Set in Africa, based on African legend, made by a French movie maker with Belgian and German backing, which is very interesting.
That is interesting.
Modern Belgian. We're not talking Leo. We're not.
Okay.
This movie is 10 years old.
Good to know. All right. Yeah,
exactly. Yeah. And I'm only learning about Leopold in the last year or so.
Well, but that's an example, again, of how we're never going to be able to come to terms with the source of a lot of the stuff that we've come up with in this society, and the source of a lot of the wealth that we currently still hold and so on, is from colonialism, is from outright theft of ideas, in some cases syncretic borrowing and sharing of ideas. In some cases, it was not a theft, it was an exchange. But
that's when it's a folk tale handed down.
In a lot of cases, yeah. But I mean,
then there's theft.
Well, yeah. And so with respect to science fiction and fantasy, one of the things that I was talking about was the fact that, you know, me as a young woman, I'm 42 now. Oh my God. Anyway, as a black woman who tries to function in this genre, in a lot of cases and a lot of times, I am treated as though I am a unicorn. Like there have never been any before me, da 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 da. And I talk...
Well, too many people there haven't.
Yeah. And I've talked in a lot of cases about how when I was young and I was trying to... I was a huge science fiction and fantasy nerd from, like, birth. But as I started reading it as a child, I started to disengage from it until I happened upon Octavia Butler's books. And I could not tell that she was a black writer. The cover of the edition that I saw of Dawn had been whitewashed. There was no author photo in it. There was no mention there's no mention of most people's race in fiction, but in that particular case, it seemed like a deliberate exclusion, a deliberate effort to
market.
Obfuscate.
Obfuscate, but there's a simple word for everything you're saying.
Right.
Market. It explains
it's marketing,
it all.
But it's marketing that assumes that a black face will not sell, or a black face is actually a detriment to selling.
That is the presumption.
Yeah. And so that was what I grew up with. And also, you know, I told you, for example, about how Dad and I used to watch The Twilight Zone and Star Trek and so forth. Every black person I know is a freaking nerd who has been watching this stuff too, or who's been reading this stuff too. There's a huge population of people of color and women who've been supporting conventions and running conventions for all these years. All of these people are part of this genre just as much as the straight white guys who get all of the awards and the accolades are.
But
that's my point.
Those same people are themselves, they are fans of it, but up until a certain time, I would say, we're totally disenfranchised from it.
Yeah.
Because I would go to, I've been going to science fiction conventions since I started at WBAI, 1967. It's a few years now.
Mm-hmm.
And I have always seen women very active Star Trek fandom conventions were created in New York by women.
Mm-hmm.
And most of the people running conventions were out of proportion to other parts of society, women, and not people of color not running it, mm-hmm. but attending and mm-hmm. being a part. And I saw more Black people and Hispanic people of color at science fiction conventions and elsewhere, but I was still not finding their books, not finding their writing. 20 years ago, and I said this on the air famously, and people will find those air checks and rebroadcast them. I could say I can name the number of quality science fiction writers who are being published on one hand, at least currently as of that time. You know, Stephen Barnes, Chip Delaney, Octavia Butler. I knew a few more. There was a guy named Jesse Miller, who sold a couple of stories to Analog, and there were things here and there. And this is one of the reasons why I keep going on and on and on about
Charles
the person.
Saunders and,
But I really think that the thing that changed everything there was Dark Matter.
Dark Matter, and
by the way, Sheree Thomas will be on the show in 2 weeks, but by phone. But
Dark Matter brought a lot of what had always been there into the mainstream's light.
Right.
But, you know...
Into the genre reader's light. I'm reading this and I'm going, I did not realize that such and such a person was writing... I wasn't aware that...
I hadn't realized that W.E.B. Du Bois had written... science fiction.
Word for word, that was the sentence I was about to say.
Exactly. But that was the thing that rocked my world.
It's an eye-opener. It's a consciousness raiser. And more important than that is I think that it gave encouragement. Okay, by that time, yes, Octavia Butler had achieved the... respect that she deserved, and starting fame, but only starting in its way as far as mainstream is concerned. And mainstream still doesn't quite know her. But what Dark Matter did was it told readers of color, you can write this stuff. It was a point of encouragement, I think. It was a... So that the people who I used to see attending the conventions might now stop writing just fanfic and start submitting, and publishers start buying. This is my hope.
Let me... Speaking as a reader of color who needed to see Dark Matter, it didn't tell me you can write this stuff. It told me you have always been writing this stuff. You have always been here. You never were not.
Okay, let me rephrase that. You should be publishing this stuff.
Octavia Butler told me that. But what it helped me understand was that the hidden part of science fiction that I had always seen as a Black geek, as someone who's, you know, like when I was at Tulane, I was involved in, you know, Dungeons and Dragons style tabletop role playing with a group of mostly Black, Latino, and Asian people. And there had already been a crew on campus for years doing it, but they were almost all white boys. And when you walked in, they stared at you like you were an interesting new bug. And so I went to a group of people where I wasn't immediately seen as an interloper. And that group had been existing for years, too, quietly. And that's an example of the kind of thing we're talking about. You don't see a lot of Black folks, even still today, at science fiction and fantasy conventions, because they are painfully uncomfortable places to be. And a lot of cons are slowly beginning to address that. But, you know, for a long time, they were just really uncomfortable places to be. But that didn't mean that there weren't gatherings of geeks of color. They were just doing it somewhere else.
Yeah, maybe I was lucky in some of the cons I was going to. I have to say, when LunaCon was held in New York City, as opposed to in Westchester, it was very multicultural. In terms of its attendance, not in terms of its programming or its guests, but in terms of who do you see, who was I palling with?
Right. Well, for me, the reason that I am coming out of anime fandom is because that is where I found welcome with the other geeks. You know, science fiction and fantasy fandom was not especially welcoming. But if I, you know, went to an anime con, it was incredibly diverse. It was mostly young people. There were all sorts of people there from all walks of life, and I felt part of a group. And in fact, to the point that I decided, let's start up one. That was ShoujoCon. I was trying to create a convention for that was sort of aimed at women or young women, featuring works by women authors and women creators. Mm-hmm. And it was amazing. Shoujo is one of the most popular art forms for sub-forms of manga and anime in Japan. So, you know, and that's largely because they don't have that whole creepy genderish. You know, they've got different gender issues. They don't have the same gender issues. But, you know, the gender issues that they have there are not about suppressing a group of people that exists. It is about separating them off and making them do their own thing, which is its own problem. But they were able to thrive there. Women who were comics creators and that sort of thing, and women who were comics fans, were able to thrive there in a way that they've been essentially driven out here or suppressed, actively suppressed here. And that's the thing I was talking about in that speech, the reconciliation speech at Continuum. So I called for people to begin acknowledging those kinds of deliberate exclusions, those efforts or in some cases not deliberate exclusions, but just you're not important enough for me to think about, or this issue isn't important enough for me to think about. Those kinds of exclusions as well are the things that tend to create an unwelcoming environment for lots of folks. But then the next year, my speech at WISCON this year was essentially kind of taking that back. Because I'd also studied more about reconciliations and realized you can't have a reconciliation until the actual exclusion and disenfranchisement is done. And that has not ended. That is still happening in a lot of parts of this genre and this field. There are still people who believe, well, why should we have a sexual harassment policy at this convention? You know, women should just suck it up. Whatever. Or why should we try and make it easier for poor people to get to this convention that's way out in outer Boondockia? They should, you know, I found a way to get here. I had friends that were able to bring me here. Why can't they? Da 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 da. These are still exclusions. These are still things keeping.
Curiously, mm-hmm. there have always been funds. There was the TAF fund, the Transatlantic mm-hmm. Fan Fund, to send some generally white person to some place in Europe. There was Duff, the Down Under Fan Fund.
And but how were these advertised to the people that might have needed them more?
You at cons.
That's the thing.
And in
if fanzines. You're not already coming to a con.
That's right. No, you have to be. You have to
exactly.
be. The point is, mm-hmm. you're an American con goer. Mm-hmm. We will send you to a con mm-hmm. that you otherwise couldn't afford to.
Which
there's
is why
there's no such concept as Carl Brandon. Mm-hmm. I never met him at a convention. there were a few.
Yeah.
We have to explain. Carl Brandon doesn't exist. Yeah. Except as a new fund to help people become writers and attend conventions and all that, specifically people of color, and well, it's something worth donating to.
The legend of Carl Brandon that I heard was
please.
That for
I don't know the legend.
For and I don't know if this is true or not. You can touch base with the Carl Brandon Society. Basically, it was a way for people of color at mostly white conventions to feel like they weren't the only person there. So they would, you know, when they saw like the other one or two people of color at that convention, they would go over and be like, "Have you seen Carl?"
Right.
And it would just make it was a way of sort of signaling to the other person that I notice you. Hey, look, there's two of us here. Isn't that awesome? Also, there's another one, you know, and we're not alone here. Or there is a spirit of people who are here who weren't able to make it. But, you know, it's just
and
a way of
such
sort
a
of,
horrible,
it was
horrible
a support mechanism.
Because the whole idea of science fiction fandom, mm-hmm. fandom, you know, we have, you know, it's a loud, it's a proud and lonely thing to be a fan. There's firewall. Mm-hmm. Fandom is a way of life versus mm-hmm. fijag. Fandom is just a goddamn hobby. Mm-hmm. Fandom, science fiction fandom, mm-hmm. appas, their whole language, the mm-hmm. word fandom, all of this mm-hmm. comes out of people who geeky people mm-hmm. who say we are different from the rest of the society. Mm-hmm. We are not seen. We have to band together because we are different. Mm-hmm. And then they built walls. Or society had walls around them that prevented other people from getting in.
No, it's more like they weren't as different as they thought they were. That's all.
Better. I think you're
I
right.
I mean, if
I take
you
it
were,
all back. Yeah.
I mean, what you just said. There was a sense of difference, or there was an embrace of the idea of difference. But you know, if you've still got a mostly white, wealthy, I'm using wealthy in the sense of can afford to splurge money on going to a convention that requires flying across the country or something to get to da 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 da. You know, if you've got
I slept 9 to a room and
even so, hitchhiked. You still, could afford to hitchhike, or you could hitchhike in a way that wouldn't get you killed. So you had the privilege of not being beaten down by the KKK on the way. There you go. But that said, if you are part of the group of people that has that particular set of privileges and you don't recognize that as a privilege, and you don't recognize that being able to hitchhike without getting raped or lynched or something is in and of itself a privilege, even though it may not seem like such, then of course you're going to continue to replicate the structures that help to exclude other people. Because if you don't see it, then what are you going to do about it?
I don't believe people see it, because I believe that privilege is invisible to the person who has it if you're born into it.
Until it's pointed out to you.
That's why consciousness raising is so essential.
I am still, you know, kind of wrapping my head around cisgender privilege, which I have. As a woman who looks like a woman, who's never doubted that she was a woman or never had any cause to question my own womanhood, I'm still kind of learning about trans issues. This is something that I've got to understand, though, because especially for trans women of color or trans people of color, it's a life and death issue. We've got to try and find a way to address these things. It is literally life and death. So I have the privilege of being able to walk down the street as the person that I am without the chance that someone might see me and just randomly decide to kill me because I'm a threat to their masculinity by existing.
Yeah.
Or whatever. So, you know, these are all things that we've got to kind of come to terms with, and we all have to confront and accept. And that is something that we are still in the process of doing. Ergo, we cannot have a reconciliation until we've reached the point of admitting the damage done.
Well, the thing
and stopping the damage done.
I couldn't agree more. The thing that has always given me anger as my consciousness got raised and can hopefully continues to be raised in various increments is, but science fiction is the place where this is supposed to be different. We are the ones who are looking ahead.
We are the ones who tell ourselves we're looking ahead.
I'm giving the party line.
Yeah.
Okay. We are the ones who can come up with alternate universes and do the if this goes on kind of thing. And I remember there was a time many, many years ago when I was doing a midnight to 5 a.m. slot. I was playing some radio drama on the air. I don't remember what it was. It was an X-1 or something like that. And I got a phone call from not an angry but very reasonable person saying, you know, here you have this story in the science fiction, and I take note that the women are not on their hands and knees scrubbing the house. They're pressing the buttons that clean the house, but it's the women who are cleaning the house and the men who have the jobs in this idyllic, beautiful future. I stopped the tape that I was broadcasting at that moment and put this phone call on the air because I'm just like, I've never thought of this. I've never heard of this.
Yeah.
And it's true. And my discomfort and anger started rising at, wait a minute, we're the good guys. We're the ones, the science fiction fantasy writers who are supposed to be looking into a better, or at that time, science fiction was looking more towards utopia and improving things. Today, mm-hmm. science fiction is very dystopic. It's mm-hmm. very Cassandra, mm-hmm. awful
mm-hmm. yeah.
kind of stuff, and very, very negative outlook on the world.
I think it's become more realistic. But, I mean, you know, what you're talking about is did we listen to our own press? You know, the science fiction field
is starting to. Things taking decades.
Slowly. Yeah, the science fiction field is as cutting edge and as free of all of those issues as America is the land of opportunity. We can talk about the reality, we can talk about the propaganda.
If America hadn't been the land of opportunity, my parents would have been killed in Germany, and almost were. But then you come here and the streets are paved with something other than gold.
Yeah. You know, if they're paved, we don't have any infrastructure anymore.
And then all you get to do is clean your shoes after that.
If you don't fall into a pothole and die.
So, you're tuned to listener-sponsored non-commercial Pacifico Radio in New York City, WBAI at 99.5 FM. This is Hour of the Wolf. My name is Jim Freund. This is a pre-recorded earlier today, today being November, what did we decide? It was on the 26th,
I think.
26th. The day, actually.
Day before Thanksgiving.
But yeah, actually, when you're hearing this, it is mm-hmm. Thanksgiving.
Oh, yeah, there you go.
Because the show starts at 1 a.m., running to 3. Thank you, Mario Murillo, our interim program director, for enabling me with a different half hour. And my guest is N.K. Jemison, a.k.a. Nora Jemison.
Yeah.
But when you meet the person, it's Nora. Mm-hmm. When you find the stories in the books,
it's N.K.
And it's N.K.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so you mm-hmm. were going to... since we're recording in a non-studio environment, you'll hear a fireplace in the background, occasional rain, and depending on when my neighbors get home, a baby crying. Well, he's 3 years old, but still. Oh, he pounds. Oh, my God. Anyway.
Oh, okay. All right, I am going to be reading the first few. Do you want me to just get into it, or do you want me to? It's just a short story. It's a novella. Okay, so this is The Awakened Kingdom. It is a sequel novella to the Inheritance trilogy. It is not directly related to the plot of the other books, set in the same universe, and you will see some familiar faces, I suspect. I'm going to read the first few pages of this, and starting now. I am born. Hello. Many things happen. The end. Hello again. How are you? I am fine. I have learned more about proper ways from Papa Tempa. Papa said that what I did before was not the proper way to tell a story, so I will do it over. I do not like the way he says I should tell it, though. That is boring. I want to make you feel like I feel. So I will talk like I think when stuff was happening, and I will start from the very beginning when my thinking was not so good because I was extra new. I am glad you are with me. You are new, too, and now we can be new together. We have much to learn, everyone says, but I have learned a great deal already. I will share it with you. See, here is what I learned today. How to speak to others without making them angry, and how to run if I do make them angry, and how not to blur myself into another so that both of us are lost, and how to come close to Maelstrom without dissolution, and how to name all the names of all the pieces of existence. I learned that besides Maelstrom and existence, there is also nothingness, and it goes on for a long, long way. Forever. It is not safe to go there, says Naha. She took me to the edge of the god's realm and showed me. It is very scary, but then so is Naha. Do you know Naha? And Papa Tempa and Mama Yena? You should know them. They encompass all the fullness of existence that the soul can grasp. I will take you to meet them. They will like you. You'll see. Hello. Mama Yena says I do not have to say hello every time I see somebody I already know. Also, Papa Tempa tells me I am doing a wrong thing again. I am supposed to respect time, because that is a thing he has made for the place where mortals live, and you come from there. You might forget this if I tell it to you now, so I will tell it to you later, and you will remember it when you reach now. That will happen in the God's realm when you go there, which is where you are now, so don't forget. I do not know why you were confused. I explained it fine. Okay. Now I will tell my story. Imagine that you have just been born. It is very confusing. Not like time. Time is easy. There's a lot of pain and messiness, and then suddenly everything is new and different and cold and bright. And then something says, be, and there you are. And while you lie there screaming, there are hands that touch you and warmth that folds around you. And there are voices, and they are familiar because you have heard them since long before your birth. So you are comforted. But you scream again because the world blurs, and that is when suddenly you discover words like agoraphobia and vertigo and you and other. You do not want to learn these words, but you have no choice. You know world, too, which you sort of knew before, except it once meant something entirely different. Once, world was warm and dark and close. Now world is different, and you must start all over again before learning how it works. This is not fair, but world, the world, is often unfair. And then a really bad thing happens. You were wanted. Mama and Papa and Naha wanted you lots. You know this, and you know there is a space carved into existence which is shaped like a godling, and that godling is supposed to be you. The hole was left when biggest sibling went away. By that I mean he died. His name was Cie. Now imagine you are supposed to be Cie. Well, not really. Cie is dead. But you were made to fill the hole he left behind, to be the trickster in the wind, mischief and cruelty, the cat and the boy and the cranky old man. Imagine the three have shaped you so, so carefully to match the hole. You will be different from Cie that was, but you will be important in the same way. You will be powerful in the same way. The planets will follow you, and the mortals will tell tales of you, and you will steal all the suns, but only keep the ones that want to be your friend. Without a trickster, the universe will not end, but it will be a much duller place. But when you are born, things are different, wrong. You do not quite feel of caprice and wind and madness. You try these things, and because you are a god, things happen, but they are not the things that should happen, and they do not nourish you. They do not inform you. You are something steadier than caprice, heavier than wind. And when you curl yourself into various shapes, it is womanness that calls to you, except when you make shapes that do not have womanness. Like amoebas. I like being an amoeba. Glurgle, glurgle, squish, chomp. You are not what your parents want you to be. You are not what you want to be, because you love them, your parents, and you want to make them happy, and you just can't. In fact, now you have no idea what you should be instead. You are incomplete. It is very sad. I was very sad. But then something changed and I got mad because it was so unfair. I did everything right. I was born and everything. Life should have just been perfect for me, and suddenly it was not, and everything was just awful. So I went around for a while mad. I made hells and kicked them, and I did not feel any better, so I let them fade away. I asked Mama to help me make some life to kick instead, and she looked at me in a scary way and said that life is not mine to play with. She gave me some knowledge to study, though, and that made me bigger, which is why I'm not talking in quite so many exclamations now. But once I had learned it, I was bored again and mad again, so I went off looking for something else to do. I talked to some siblings. Some of them did not want to talk to me, but others did. One called the Dreamer told me that he had not been able to find himself for a long, long time. So long that he gave up trying and thought it would never happen and resolved to just be sad and empty forever. But then it happened. It will happen, he said, which made me feel better. I asked him how he'd made himself be less empty during that long time, and he said he had filled the emptiness with other people's love for a little while. But without love of the self, others' love will never be enough. I didn't understand that part, so I just nodded and went away. Then I tried to talk to Spider Many-Sighted, and she just laughed and threw webs around me and talked gibberish, and I almost died. I went away before I could. I don't think I like her much. Then I talked to Rawl the Dragon, which is hard because all it does is spit fire and roar. So I tried spitting fire and roaring along with it, and it didn't spit any fire at me, so I guess that was okay. When I was done, I felt even more better, but I was still mad. So finally, I went to the wall of torn stars, which is the edge of the maelstrom, and I just sat there and felt bad for a while. And I thought, this is so unfair. I should be CA. And then I thought, why can't I be CA? And then I thought, ooh, I thought, maybe I can make me be CA. Ooh. There isn't any rule against it. It's what the three wanted, and it's important to obey them, isn't it? Nobody said I couldn't. So I went back to Spider and I played a trick. I tied her realm to Rall the Dragon's and ran away before either of them could see what I had done. They started fighting, and I tried to laugh at them to feel proud of what I had done because it was good mischief, and that is what CA would have done. Except it wasn't funny. Spider had been mean to me, but Rall had been nice, and I didn't like being mean. I decided maybe I was doing mischief wrong. I tried again, this time sneaking into Elhodi's infinite garden and switching things around so they bloomed out of season and grew next to things that would eat them and making all the flowers be polka-dotted. And then I waited nearby to see what would happen when Elhodi found it. I thought he would get angry, and then I would laugh, and it would be okay because I hadn't met Elhodi at all, and he hadn't been either mean or nice. But when Elhodi came in, he started to cry. Really? I felt bad then. I realized his garden had been beautiful, and I'd made it ugly, and being mischievous wasn't any fun at all. I came out of hiding and said I was sorry. He let me help put everything back, which made us both feel better. Then he said, why? Or rather, he rustled a little, because Elhodi only speaks in plant, but I figured it out. I thought I could make me be CA, I said. This is what he would do, isn't it? Elhodi just stared at me for a minute, then shook his head in a bobbing, windblown sort of way. Then he touched me and took me back to the center of the God's realm, where the three were just finishing whatever they'd been doing there. When he spoke to them and left me there, I thought I would be in trouble, so I stood before them and bowed my head and waited to be punished for being bad. They sort of looked at each other, and then all of them sort of sighed, and then Naha and Yena vanished, and Etempest took my hand and sat me down. You do not understand your purpose, he said. Which I thought was silly, because, duh, I knew that. That was kind of the whole point. He shook his head. Not nature. Purpose. Why, not what. You misunderstand the reason for your creation. I frowned. To be CA, I said. I mean, to be what he was. No. Now I was very confused. Why did you make me then? To live. I was even more confused. I'm alive, but I'm not what you want me to be. There is nothing that we want you to be besides yourself. You are everything we desired of you. I really, really, really didn't understand. So I shut up and tried to think about it and still didn't understand. Etempest sighed and conjured an image of CA in his favorite mortal shape. Tiny, mammalian, wavering a little between big-headed boy and spindly old man and sleek black cat. Shapes, plural. I had heard that mortals did not blur themselves the way we did. As if to emphasize this, Etempest fixed the image on the boy, who stared back at us with Yena's lively, deadly eyes. And because this was Etempest and he liked to be precise, I did more than see CA, I felt him, as he must have seemed to everyone who met him in life. There was so much of him. He'd been nothing like I thought. His soul was so heavy that everything was pulled toward him. Everyone thought about him. Every event involved him to at least a tiny degree. Wow, he didn't feel like a godling at all. I got really ashamed then, because that was when I knew I hadn't done my tricks wrong. I just wasn't enough to do them right. What you detect in us is something called grief, Etempest said, speaking very softly for a moment. That is, the wound left behind when something integral to the self is taken away. I gasped, finally understanding. The hole! I didn't fit it. Etempest is good at words, and he knew what I meant, even if I didn't know how to say it right. It is a kind of void, yes. No one can fit the one left by a specific soul, however. Such a void is unique. So I wasn't even supposed to try to fit it? I fidgeted. Wounds get better. What makes grief get better? Nothing. Time can ease it, but nothing ends it. That sounded awful. Grief sounds like a bad thing, I said, frowning. Why don't you and Naha and Mama get rid of it? That would require removing love from existence. Do you believe it would be a good thing to do so? I thought hard. I loved Mama and Papa and Naha. I loved some of my siblings. I loved the wall of torn stars and the tiny glowing flowers in El Hodi's garden that I'd helped him replant. I did not want to stop loving things. No. He inclined his head, which made me feel very grown up. Such things are better endured than avoided. I tried to imagine having a wound that would never heal. I couldn't. I knew what pain was. I had felt lots of that when I was born, and it was a terrible, scary thing, but usually pain went away after a while. How do you endure something that never ends? That is something many of us are still learning. Gods are particularly bad at it. He sighed and let Cie's image vanish into the swirls of ether. Our grief separates unchecked and unfading for eternities. We invariably inflict new pain in an effort to ease the old. That tendency has caused so much harm to existence that we now understand we can no longer afford to indulge it. Oh, what do you do instead? He conjured another image. A planet, smaller than most, wet, green with life. We learn from mortals. They are small and weak creatures in so many ways, but in love, they are our equals. In grief, they are stronger. Stronger? Everything everyone had told me about mortals made them sound like funny little pets. Yes, they were made to endure death on a scale we cannot imagine. Abruptly, Eutempus made a funny face. I had never seen his face be like this. So, lately, we have attempted to change. It is a mortal technique to counter death with life. Life. Me. Oh! Finally, I understood, which was good because Papa Tempo was hurting himself to try to make me understand. He was trying, though, because sometimes it is better to change than to do bad things. And that is what he was trying to tell me. It's hard for Papa Tempa to change, but not as hard as it was for him to be alone, my siblings had told me, so we tried always to make sure he was not. But I squirmed, because something he had said bothered me. You made me so you wouldn't do more bad things? Siblings had told me all about the God's War. No, Eutempus said, and now he sounded strong again. We made you because you are a good thing. This made me curl up and want to go back to the wall of torn stars. I don't know what that means, though. He inclined his head. Your confusion and frustration are normal. This is part of life. Well, I don't like life, then. Eutempus's eyes sort of crinkled and his mouth sort of curved, and he touched me for a moment, all proud, warm, and firm. Don't let your mother hear you say that. He considered. Or Nahadoth, if she is bored. Then he pulled away and gathered himself to leave. I jumped up. Wait! Papa! If there was a proper way to be alive, he would know how to get me started, at least. I don't know what to do next. Eutempus paused, considering, and then he lowered his sun-colored gaze. Perhaps it was the right choice for you to study Cie's life, he said. He lived better than most of us. Abruptly, he leveled a hard look at me. Do not emulate him, however. That is easy and foolish. Learn from him, his mistakes as well as his accomplishments. Then become yourself. He went away then. I still didn't understand, but at least I felt better. That is why I like Papa Tempa best. So I made myself some feet and kicked them for a while, and I thought and thought and thought. And finally I decided what you probably know I decided because I have already done it, and if I hadn't, I wouldn't be here talking to you. I decided to go to the mortal realm. This was really bad, because Naha had said the mortal realm was a terrible place where bad things happen to gods. Then she'd held me for a long time without talking at all, which I understood better now that Papa Temba had told me about grief. I didn't really want to go to a place that was full of grief, but Xie had spent a lot of time there, and the things that had happened to him there had been really, really important. Everyone said he'd gotten stronger there. And Mama Yena had come from there, and she was terrible but also really amazing, so obviously the mortal realm was not all bad. So I decided I would go there too, and maybe get stronger, and try not to die. I did not want to make more grief. In the mortal realm, there is a world that is very special. This was the planet Papa Tempa had shown me. It is special for bad reasons, mostly like killing a lot of us. But it is also the world most of us go to when we visit the mortal realm. So I packed myself up and wrapped myself in skin and some bones and stuff. I picked stuff that was different from Xie's, just like Etempus had said, which meant that when I became a big-headed human, I made myself smaller and browner and girlier. And I gave myself pretty gold eyes like Papa's instead of green ones like Mama's.
I'm an alien from outer space. I'm a cyber girl without a face. A heart or a mind.
Once again, what is it that you were reading, Nora? Tell the listening audience exactly what it was, mm-hmm. where it's available,
mm-hmm.
and all that good stuff.
I was reading from the novella The Awakened Kingdom, which is a follow-up novella to the Inheritance Trilogy.
So for all of those people who think that they, you know, they started with 100,000 kingdoms and worked their way through the entire trilogy... There's more.
It does stand alone. They probably should read the trilogy first.
Yes.
Because there's all these characters in it who won't have any real relevance to the reader unless, or in situations that won't have a lot of relevance to the leader and to the reader unless they have known what's gone before. But so it does stand alone.
It would be nice, he said leadingly, if there were one volume that encompassed the trilogy
yes.
and that novella.
The novella is available in the new Inheritance Trilogy omnibus that is out in December 1st from Orbit Books. And it also is available as a standalone e-novella from Orbit Short Fiction that you can find on the Orbit website.
Oh, so, not see that.
Yeah,
I didn't
you
know.
You can buy it as a standalone novella for $2.99,
mm-hmm.
Or you can buy the entire ginormous volume. Impress your friends.
Now, impress yourself.
Kill a lot of bugs.
The
really
Inheritance
easily.
Trilogy. Yeah, you keep going on about the size of that. And
that's
the
sound of this book.
Yeah, okay. and it holds that impact as well, may I say, when you read it. It's an amazing debut, The 100,000 Kingdoms. And I have a claim to fame about that book that you may or may not remember.
Okay.
There was a reading. I don't remember what it was. Mm-hmm. It was probably something Tempest Bradford was putting on
okay.
at Blue Stocking Books.
I remember that.
And I was there very early, and you were there very early, and mm-hmm. I had an ARC, an advanced reader copy.
Ah. I remember
of your book.
That.
Uh-huh. And I was the first person ever to ask you to autograph one of your books.
I do remember that.
Yeah, okay.
That's true.
Yeah.
That was also the first time I read Non-Zero Probabilities, which is my Nebula and Hugo nominated short story. So
yeah. So and somewhere I ought to have a recording of that. Because I think.
I remember.
But remember, recording at Blue Stockings. Mm-hmm. Is even noisier than recording here.
Yeah.
Out of my apartment.
And but there was a packed house at that reading.
It was a packed house, yeah. But it's a noisy atmosphere. Bookstores are never that good. Mm. But it's a claim to fame that I have that I'm the first person to ask you and receive an autograph. So we have the Inheritance Trilogy in print, Killing Moon and second book.
The Shadowed Son of the Dreamblood?
Yes. The two Dreamblood novels.
Yes. And
in print. In other words, what can people go out and buy today of your work?
They can buy my five novels in most bookstores, on Amazon, Barnes & Noble, all of the online stores. Everything is available and in print. Let's see. They can find my short stories in different locations, but if you go to my website, which is N.K. Jemisin, that is N.K.J.E.M.I.S.I.N.com, you can find the bibliography, which points you towards everything. And there are also excerpts of the novels on my website as well, if you want to read the first chapter or so and decide.
Yeah, that's a great way to go in. But I've decided for all the listeners. So just go out and get them. But nkjemisin.com. I always used to misspell it as O-N, it's as I-N.
Yes.
That's the tricky part at the end. And more books coming out, a short story coming out in about 2 weeks at light speed. One of these days we'll figure out which it was. And it's been too long. It's been an absolute pleasure having you here.
Oh, thank you. And thanks for having me.
Thank you.
been listening to Hour of the Wolf. My name is Jim Freund. My guest has been N.K. Jemisin. And next week, our guest will be Jennifer Marie Brissett. Thank you very much for listening. Please be good to each other, especially those of you who have been justifiably angered this week. Have a good Thanksgiving. Good morning.
Radio station WBAI 99.5 FM New York, WBAI.org.
Sunday, November 30th at 11 p.m., Shug in My Bowl presents Joseph Daly, low brass specialist on tuba, euphonium, and trombone. Join us as we present the second of a two-part discussion with Joseph Daly. That's Sunday, November 30th at 11 p.m., right here on WBAI New York, 99.5 FM, and WBAI.org on the web.
Hi, this is Jake Sufnarowski, former talent buyer at Wetlands Preserve. When I'm not driving my gas-guzzling SUV, texting my friends in my handheld mobile device, or listening to my local Clear Channel affiliate, I'm definitely tuned to WBAI, listener-supported non-commercial radio in New York City, 99.5 FM.
Children, this is Reverend Billy from the Church of Stop Shopping. You're listening to WBAI FM 99.5 New York City. It's listener-sponsored, children. It's commercial-free. Ooh, change-a-looyah.
Check it out, y'all. This is Freddie Sheffield. You're listening to WBAI 99.5 FM, New York, New York. Listener-sponsored free speech radio. Come on out every first Monday and check out Two Raw for Radio Comedy Experience. We got a reception that goes down at 6:30 p.m. and 8 p.m. is showtime. Tickets and info is available at www.wbai.org. And the place to be is the WBAI headquarters located at 388 Atlantic Avenue, Brooklyn, New York. See you there.
Sego, this is John Kane. Join me and First Voices Indigenous Radio for a special three-hour First Voices on Thursday, November 27th. That's Thanksgiving Day, Thursday morning, from 9 till noon. I will have a solid lineup of guests throughout the program, including Teokas and Ghost Horse. I know you've missed him, and he'll return for this special program, along with a quality lineup of other guests. We'll go beyond the myths of happy pilgrims and Indians with an educational and entertaining program. That's Thanksgiving morning from 9 till noon on First Voices Indigenous Radio on WBAI.
Thanks to you.
Thank each and every one of you for coming by.
And while he's thanking those folks, let me take this opportunity to thank all of you, our listeners and support staff, our contributors, our interns, the volunteers, producers, and the entire crew that works countless hours to bring WBAI into your lives.
When I leave, you can remember I said, with the last words on my lips, I am a revolutionary. And you're going to have to keep on saying that. You're going to have to say that I am a proletarian.
Trying to reach
crew put on hold. The bold lose control, so they force obedience. Have you pledge allegiance to a piece of cloth? That's off the way I see it. Well, I'm going off berserk, cause the system work to jerk. My people, the people, all around the pig work. Tell me I'm wrong, though, that's my right, and it's right in the Constitution. Yo, that's an illusion, huh? Suckers trying to change and rearrange. They say that I'm free, but they sure have a strange way of showing it. But I'm blowing the cover, the red, white, the blue, but the black for the brother. And I'm no lover of this flag, like many others take the same turn. Like me, they yearn for the flag too. Born the material of the imperialist in a blazing inferno, cause my hurt is internal. The American dream, a nightmare. I want the people to wake up to the lies, the pigs make up imperialistic swans that I grind into bacon bits. Call the fist, cause I ain't taking. I'm not a Nazi or a Cappy or a Farmy, but you want me in prison, cause I'm messy attack. The flag, I ragging and snagging and dragging and rip it to shreds, cause I'm too black, too strong, too red, too dread. And I'm dreaded cause I make the pigs tremble when I burn a symbol. Yo, I'm quick and nimble like Jack, but I'm a black man attacking the flag. I keep my torch handy, I'm no Yankee Doodle Dandy, so just hand me a flag from the fastest and watch me burn that piece up to ashes. Cause the real meaning is what the masses must learn. That's why the red, white, and blue must burn, baby, burn. Let's find the people who hate this. These are the places we'll hit.
Panama, talking about Peru, Azania, Brixton, Belfast, can't forget Korea, Beirut, can't forget Haiti, Iran, Puerto Rico, Colombia, Mexico, talking about uptown, Harlem, New York City, y'all, and Nicaragua, East and South Central, LA, California, IA, Miami, do or die, Bed-Stuy, never ran, never will, Brownsville, boogie down, South Bronx, yeah.
My man Joey to jail, and now they got him in court because he burned the flag. That's the name of the game. Well, I quit playing. I doubt the suckers want you to hear what I'm saying about this nation. Freedom supposed to be the format, but I step on your flag like it's a floor mat. Maim and mangle, the star spangled. I'm not trying to diss you. I use the flag like toilet tissue to wipe my black ass. What? Think that I'm a jackass? I see a flag and I attack fast with some fire. My desire to burn what Betty Ross sold up. The truth I show up about America, America, home of the brave, land of the free. Boom! This is the home of the slave. Now hold on just a mother minute. You gave me freedom of speech in the First Amendment. So why wanna scold me when I torch the flag? I'm only doing what you told me. You don't like it, so what? I'm not scared of you. Your flag, America too. See, I made up this new rule and I want y'all to learn it. Strike a match to the American flag and burn it.
This is Burn Baby Burn, y'all.
Revolution.
99.5.
Revolution.
List alive. Not can. Where we burn the imperialist red, white, and blue to ashes with no apology. Yeah. From Ferguson. Afghanistan, this is what we do, make proletariat revolution, yeah.
It is a revolution.
Revolution.
To make a solution. Too much confusion. So much frustration. Prisoners must be free, yeah. Never make a politician grant you a favor. They will always want to control you forever.
Fights with death night.